The following Dharma talk was given at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota. The speaker is Mark Nunberg, guiding teacher at Common Ground.
Welcome, everyone. Big welcome to anybody who is here for the first time. And usually at the end of the month like this, I just remind us all about how the center operates on this with this circle of giving and receiving. And in many ways, it's a more challenging practice to learn how to use the center, be part of this, the community here, and to receive it as a free gift. And like the whole path of waking up, we want to wake up to what that's like, to receive a gift. And of course, this gift exists because of the people before us who made it possible, all the way back to all the women and men, folks that practiced before us, and so we have these teachings, one generation after another, and more specifically, all the people who made this building and this particular center possible. And then it's challenging to receive it as a free gift, really let it in, let it touch our hearts, and not to be suspicious or not to feel uncomfortable with receiving a gift. And then if at any time you feel naturally, organically, like you want to give back, then just be aware of that movement in your heart and find a way for that to be expressed in a way that makes sense in your life. And of course, everyone's life situation is different. So how that looks, what that looks like, is going to be different for each of us, whether you're volunteering time or offering financial contributions to the center. But this is how we've been operating since 1993, for a long time now, in the circle of giving and receiving, not offering or asking or having suggested donations or fees for any of the programs, but just encouraging people to wake up to what it feels like to receive the center and the programs as a free gift, no strings attached. And if it ever arises for us to want to give back, to let that, to be aware of that and to act on that wholesome force, movement of generosity, whatever that might look like in your life. And so, you know, as an organization, we're like any other nonprofit of this size. So we have our, you know, the expenses. We support the teachers. We have three or four office staff, myself included, and then Gabe Keller Flores, our office manager, and Shelley Graff, the associate director, and Gail Iverson, the bookkeeper. And then a building and our property in western Wisconsin that we're developing. So sort of normal for this size of a spiritual nonprofit. And so just that circle makes all of this possible. We don't really do fundraising in the ordinary sense of the word. So if you have questions about this, just see me, or you can see Tom or Mary, who are our program hosts today, or Haya's in the office. You can check in with her about how this all works here at the center. We have more information, of course, on the website, and I think there's a handout out under the shelf or maybe next to the donation bowl in the lobby, so you can take a look at that handout too. And then the other thing special about today, you probably noticed the big table in the lobby. So once a quarter, usually we have a potluck, and on that day around the solstices and equinoxes, we also recite the refuges and precepts. So it's one of the more formal ritualistic things we do here at the center, in line with the people who have practiced, who were saw themselves as students of the Buddha for all these many centuries, 2,500 years or so, where we acknowledge what we're taking refuge in. So I want to talk about that today. Traditionally, we say we take refuge in the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. But the Buddha as a person, as a teacher, well, he's not around anymore, obviously. So it doesn't really help. I mean, emotionally, for some of you who have that kind of emotional disposition, having the sense of this historic person might be useful for you. But Buddha as an actual refuge, something to place our heart upon, well, the person won't work. What works is our own something here and now, our own in our own understanding. So what does the word Buddha point to in terms of our own direct understanding? Buddha means this awakened quality of the mind, or the one who knows. Sometimes it's talked about as the one who knows. So we sometimes even say resting in awareness. But there's something about the capacity of this mind, your heart, where instead of the mind being fixated on the particular objects that are being known in the moment, like my mind being fixated on a particular thought I have right now, or a particular sight, a particular sensation, there's a way for the mind to intuit the space of here and now, the space of the present moment, the space of knowing, right? So this gets us closer to the sense of what we mean by Buddha, not the particular objects that are showing up in the moment's experience, but that they're being known, that they're here in the space of the present moment, right? So we take refuge in that. The more the mind intuits what we mean, what the Buddha means by this word Buddha, or waking, being wakeful, being awakened, the more we get a sense of what non-attachment. One of the influential, well-known Thai Buddhist monks, Ajahn Chah, the way he describes this is the reality of non-attachment. So your heart, your mind, free of attachment, like right now in this moment, if you can intuit or sense, not the mind that's attached to particular objects, like what I'm thinking, what I'm afraid of, but if you can intuit or sense the mind that's not attached, that gets that's another sense of what we mean by the refuge of Buddha, the reality of non-attachment, or the space of the present moment. So it's not so much a thing, it's really more the absence of something, right? The absence of attachment, the absence of fixation, the absence of the mind doing its normal thing, which is identifying with particular objects. The object could be a thought we're having or an emotion that's arising, a sight, a sound, a sensation. But a mind that's not attached, not identified, doesn't have a problem with the objects of experience that are coming and going. So it's a mind that has equanimity in the moment with the objects that are present. So that's what we mean by Buddha. And we take refuge in Dhamma. So we take refuge in Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. These are Pali words. So Buddha means not the person. It's pointing to this actual quality of the heart. For lack of a better word, you can call it this awakenness, or this wakeful quality, or the reality of non-attachment, right? So that's what Buddha means. And then Dhamma means then when, to whatever degree, we have some sense of Buddha as it exists here and now in the heart, in the mind, then we can have a different relationship to Dhamma or Dharma, right? Two words mean the same thing. One is Sanskrit, one's Pali language, two languages that the teachings of the Buddha are recorded in. So the early teachings are recorded in Pali. So that's why because we're in that tradition of Buddhism, we use the word Dhamma. But some of the more recent traditions like Tibetan Buddhism and Zen Buddhism and Mahayana, they use Dharma, the Sanskrit version of that word. But that word means the way it is. So when we have a sense of the reality of non-attachment, then we can have an enlightened, liberated relationship with the objects that are here. Because now, because I know how to rest in awareness, rest in non-attachment, then I can actually be intimate with the thoughts, with the emotions, with the sights, with the sounds, with the reality of what's coming and going as objects of experience, right? I can participate. I can engage the world of objects, what we normally think of as reality, which is just, from a Buddhist point of view, part of reality, right? The object. I can be intimate with the objects because I'm taking refuge in the Buddha. Now I know how to be intimate without being attached, without being pushed around by my likes and dislikes. So I can take refuge in Dhamma. I don't have to be afraid of the messy world, the imperfect world, the world that I can't control of emotion and sight and sound and relationship and injustice and beauty, right? All the different dance of our embodied realities. So we take refuge in Buddha. We take refuge in Dhamma. What's showing up as experience, right? The objects of experience. We're sensitive to the world through the eyes, through the ears, through touch, taste and smell, and through thought and emotion, right? That's how we know the world. That's Dhamma or Dharma. And we can be intimate with Dhamma. We take refuge in it. Because the opposite of that is sort of a shadow in spiritual life, like, yeah, I can be free as long as I'm not embodied, as long as I don't have to be a sexual being with sexual feelings, right? As long as I don't have to deal with power dynamics or survival or, you know, getting along with other human beings, you know, then I can be free. But can you be free in this embodied, messy, imperfect world? You know, this human realm on this planet at this time with the forces that are swirling and moving here. That's real awakening, right? So it's about this marriage of Buddha, this capacity of the mind to be aware, to be not attached, so taking refuge in the awareness. That's not the whole truth, but it's a real important pointer, like resting in awareness, so that the heart knows how to let Dharma be Dharma, let the world be the way it is. Doesn't mean we're not here to make the world a better place, but the way to make the world a better place is we have to, in this moment, we have to meet the world as it actually is. Because it is how it is right now. And to be afraid or to be closed down or to be in denial, that sets up a relationship with the world that sort of skews or distorts our engagement, our participation. So the way we change the world is we meet it. We allow it to touch the heart. We allow it to come in. And what we find is it really breaks the heart. So when Buddha knows Dhamma, right, we take refuge in the Buddha that's able to know Dhamma, to take refuge in the way it is, that marriage breaks the heart open, tenderizes the heart. And then we have Sangha. That's the third refuge. So there's just three aspects of our practice. One is a deepening understanding of awareness, a way of being open so that we can be intimate with Dhamma the way it is, so we can participate. This third part is really showing up, not holding back, participating, engaging. So we call it Sangha. And you might hear people use that word like the common ground Sangha. Spiritual community is sort of a one more superficial definition of that word Sangha, not superficial in a bad sense, but it's really talking about enlightened community, wise, fearless, able to speak truth, able to keep quiet when that's appropriate, not afraid to show up, not afraid to engage. And we're, like I mentioned early on today, we're engaging with basic friendliness, that loving kindness, metta. We're engaging with compassion, karuna, with mudita, appreciative joy, gladness, and equanimity, upeka. These four emotions, right? That's what Sangha means. Or, you know, we could come up with our own list, a lot of forgiveness and patience and gratitude and sense of humor, right? These are the qualities that actually allow a human being to show up in all their different relationships in life. So once a quarter we practice, we say together that as a community, the point of being here together, of having a space, of practicing in the way that we practice, opening to the way it is, Buddha, knowing Dhamma, is to realize Sangha, right? This way of participating in our world, right? Because we're no longer afraid, because we're no longer seduced by our self-centered dramas, then our engagement, our participation, we say it's free, it's liberated from being fixated on our self-centered dramas. And so our participation, it doesn't mean we don't take care of ourselves, it just means we take care of everybody. Because that's what's left when we're not obsessed with our self-centered dramas, our self-centered fears, our self-centered desires. We take care of everybody, including ourselves. So our participation, our engagement is free. Free to be a decent, alive, kind, fearless human being. And those who are reading along in Guy Armstrong's book on emptiness that we've been sort of using as a complement to the talks this fall, and will continue through much of the winter, you can get this at Moon Palace Books, by the way. They'll give you a 20% discount if you want to read along. But this chapter 8 that some of you are reading, some of you maybe are ahead, but it's really talks about bearing with compassion. Bearing with emptiness. So as Buddha knows Dhamma as this simple, clear, non-attached awareness, is willing to be intimate with the way it is. Part of being intimate with the way it is, in a way, there's no going back. We start to see that everything is just nature. Even your beloved ones in your life, your kids, your partner, your dear friends, they're just this dance of nature. You know, you want to say, oh, that's Wynn, you know, or that's Sally, or that's John, or that's Dimitri, or whatever. But actually, it's nature. The person sitting next to you is the activity of nature. Your parent, if they're alive, nature. Your cat is just the activity of nature. All those people at work, just the activity of nature. And there's kind of in this practice of waking up to Buddha, the awareness that's not attached, that's not fixed, right, is losing all ground. See, when I make Charlie over there or Patrice over here, when I have that concept, and I'm attached to the meaning I have in my mind, oh, that's Patrice, or that's Sherry, or Tom, or Mary, all these people out there, when I define it and then get attached by my definition, right, I solidify the world in a way that doesn't align with reality. And then there's tension. Because then I need Patrice to be Patrice, and Sherry to be Sherry. And if they don't act accordingly, I have to massage the facts or control them. Could you start fitting better my idea of you? And then it's really hard to be around each other, you know, because we're trying to fit everyone in our boxes, you know, and we have these sort of corrupt deals with each other that I'll try to fit in your box if you try to fit in my box. And it never really works. We don't really know the box, and we can't really fit in the box anyway. And all of that neurotic stuff, in any case, is not self. It's just more of that dance of nature. It never was self. It's not a somebody trying to become natural. It's the somebody, the neurotic somebody, misunderstanding what that is. It's already nature. We're already just the activity, the empty activity of nature. So as we do this practice, we're going to need these three refuges. Because in a way, waking up is unbearable without wisdom. Why do you think we rely so strongly on our fixed ideas about things? Right? It's our defense. In a funny way, we defend ourselves. I mean, a Buddhist definition of an ordinary human being is somebody who's using, you know, most of their life energy to defend themselves against the way it is, which is hopeless. Right? And that's really the definition of dukkha or suffering, or the basic existential uneasiness, is that we have this tactic as a human being to defend ourselves against the way it is. Right? The way it is it's a dance of causes and conditions. From our relative point of view, we say this part of the dance is beautiful and this part of the dance is horrific. And then we generally argue with each other about the part we think is beautiful and the part that we think is horrific. And we generally make more horrific things in that argument with each other about what's beautiful and what's horrific. Right? And then there's the vast stuff that we just ignore because it's neither beautiful nor horrific. So we don't pay attention to it. And as we develop this intuition, cultivate this intuition of Buddha, and use Buddha to know Dhamma, to be more intimate with our actual experience, with the way it is, then something arises out of that. The beautiful and liberating side of it we call Sangha. But Sangha is, in a sense, defended by this territory that we have to traverse. There is a well-known person in our sort of U.S. tradition, one of the early Western pioneers going to Asia to learn, Jack Engler. He taught early on, but later stopped being a sort of formal Dharma teacher and became a PhD psychologist. And in his dissertation, I think at Harvard, he wrote about Dharma practice, right, as a psychological process. And he said this is a bad paraphrase, but sort of the essence of this path that the Buddha taught is really a path of grieving. It's a human being grieving, letting go, experiencing the loss of everything that we thought was true. Because everything we think is true is something we think. It's a mental construction. And however we think, no matter how refined or sublime our thoughts, the way we think about things can never be the way it actually is. The way it is isn't related to conceptual meaning. In the same way that a menu is not really in the same ballpark as eating the dish. You know, no matter how good, beautiful the photographs or how good the description of the food is, right? It's not the same as the experience of having the dish. And so it's the same thing. Philosophers or theologians might have very sophisticated ideas, conceptual meaning about the metaphysical reality or the spiritual reality or whatever, but it's not the reality. It's not Dhamma the way it is. So there's a real sense of loss. Right? So we need the compassion, we need the sense of safety that community, Sangha, enlightened community, gives us. Right? Our friends who say, we go to them and we say, my God, it feels like everything is falling away. It feels like a free fall. It feels like there's no ground to stand on. It feels like I don't know what end is up and what end is down. And our good Dharma friend says, yeah, that sounds right. Yeah, that's how it is. That's how the path is. You must be doing something right, right? Instead of saying, you need to see a psychologist and get, some therapy or some pills or, whatever. You need to stop being aware, It's dangerous. Opening to the way it is, I mean, wouldn't that be amazing if we live in a place, you know, that the existential situation depends on not looking too deeply, not being curious? I mean, can you imagine if we exist in a universe, a reality that is totally dependent on not being clear, not being honest about how it is? I mean, we'd be really screwed. And that's the first thing we have to decide. Is that what your intuition tells you? That we're existing at a time and place, a reality, whatever, that basically the appropriate way through is getting really good at distraction and superficiality, right? So that's why we have Netflix and Amazon on demand and, you know, I'm sure there are more, cable television, good novels, you know, video games, fidgets, is that what they're called? What are they called? Fidget spinners? Yeah. I haven't seen one, but I've seen them in the news. But we have these things to fill up space. It's like, don't look too closely, you know? And when we start to look closely, fortunately, a new catalog arrives in the mail, things we might want, or shows up on our screen, the computer screen or whatever, and we have something that distracts us. So when we, for whatever reason, feel the tension of needing to be distracted, and we start to peel away the layers, and then there's really no going back. And then you know you're a student of these teachings, the Buddhist teachings, because it's this path of awakening, path of cultivating, uncovering the Buddha, this ability to be awake without attachment, open without attachment, without fear, open to what? Dhamma, the way it is. And that begins a chain reaction that leads us through this grief of letting go of everything the mind was taking to be ground but actually wasn't ground anyway, into this more beautiful, liberated place of, it's really this activity of generosity. Because when we're not neurotically protecting the imagined sense of me, the heart is available to take care of everybody and everything. Not because there's anybody or anything that needs taking care of, because it's the only thing left. It's what happens when the ground of needing to protect me, needing to protect my opinions and ideas goes away, and it gets worn down. It's not like it just disappears on one day, but it just gets worn down. It just doesn't make sense to be so neurotic. I'm sure most of you, to some degree, have noticed, at least in places in our life, where it just doesn't make sense to be as neurotic as we used to be. I mean, we could, and when conditions are just right, we might fall back into being neurotic in a way we were 10 years ago. But through the course of practice, it's like, I just can't do that suffering like I used to be able to do it. You know, I just can't get so whipped up into that tight, heavy, contracted space. Why? I'd much rather inhabit this open, ambiguous, undefined, tender-hearted, broken-hearted place where I'm just figuring things out moment by moment. I don't have a grand scheme of like being a Buddhist, right? You don't have any fixed view. That's the point. That's what Sangha means. You're not operating out of a fixed view. That tender-hearted doing what's next is the liberation, not some grand scheme of what we look like when we're liberated. Be on the lookout for that, like fulfilling some vision we have of ourselves being a wise, kind human being, guaranteed to be a setup. And really, that's the responsibility as a good friend of someone, to point out what a setup that is. Like, honey, I don't know what you're doing. I mean, mostly we need to say it to ourselves, but sometimes to our dear friends, honey, I don't know what you're doing, or I don't know what I'm doing, acting in this way. But, you know, this doesn't survive the taste test. Like, this is tight. Needing to be mindful, needing to be kind, needing to be seen in any particular way is a setup. So we're really engaging this process of initially, in Buddhism, we sometimes say the practice begins and ends with right view, or begins and ends with wisdom. So that's Buddha. This is a path of wisdom. Initially, wisdom is going to be faint, but that's all we have. Some faint intuition that I can trust awareness, that, or I can trust non-attachment. But it's faint, right? And mostly, we know we can't trust attachment. It's not so much that we clearly see that I can trust non-attachment. It's just attachment doesn't make sense. Being greedy doesn't make sense. Being angry doesn't make sense. So we abandon that, and by default, we start to trust non-attachment, because that's what non-attachment is. It's the abandoning of greed and hate. Right? And then that deepens. And then we are able to connect, open to Dhamma. And we start to sense the freedom of Sangha, of that open, intimate participation and engagement, freely being a human being. And it's just like, wow, I handled that situation in a really beautiful way, precisely because I wasn't acting out some idea of who I should be in this moment. It was just nature happening, just organic. And it felt really free. So on these Sundays, when we do the refuges and precepts, we do it together. I think it's page like 36. We'll end doing that. Then the children will come in. Mary, maybe you could mention to the children that because we're doing the refuges and precepts, they don't have to come in today. And they could just join us at the potluck in about 10 minutes. So it's on page 35. And we need 5 volunteers to read each of the 5 precepts on page 36 and 37. So who would like to read the first? Do you want to do it, Haya? Who would like to do the second one? Jim, the third precept. Charlie, the fourth. Somebody want to do the fourth? Cherry, and then Andrew, you want to do the fifth? Good, and then you might notice some of us like to use this gesture. It's called Anjali. I learned it first as a Catholic. But there's something archetypal about this gesture, and just a gesture of respect and gratitude. So use it if you like. So let's do it first. We'll start with the Namo Tassas. It's acknowledging our original teacher, the Buddha. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang saranang gacchami, dhammang saranang gacchami, sanghang saranang gacchami, dutiyampi buddhang saranang gacchami, dutiyampi dhammang saranang gacchami, dutiyampi sanghang saranang gacchami, tatiyampi buddhang saranang gacchami, tatiyampi dhammang saranang gacchami, tatiyampi sanghang saranang gacchami. I take refuge in the Buddha, trusting inherent peace and freedom, a heart free from clinging. So just contemplating that for a few seconds. And now the second refuge. I take refuge in the Dhamma, trusting mindful awareness of the way things are. And just sensing that directly for a few seconds. And then the third, I take refuge in the Sangha. Show us the way. Good, and we'll do the five precepts now. First, the Pali language, then we'll read it in English, and then we'll listen to one of our community members read Thich Nhat Hanh's comments. He's a very well-known Vietnamese Buddhist monk, and his written these reflections on each of the five training precepts. So let's do the first. Panatipata where ammani sika padang samariyami. I undertake the training to refrain from harming living beings.
Aware of the suffering caused by the destruction of life, I am committed to cultivating compassion and learning ways to protect the lives of all beings. I am determined not to kill and not to let others kill, and not to condone any act of killing in the world, in my thinking and in my way of life. This is the first of the five mindfulness trainings, and I vow to study and practice it.
So we just take a few seconds and reflect on what that might look like in our lives, this commitment. And now the second. Adinadana where ammani sikapadang samariyami. I undertake the training to refrain from taking that which is not given.
Aware of the suffering caused by exploitation, social injustice, stealing, and oppression, I am committed to cultivating loving kindness and learning ways to work for the well-being of all beings. I will practice generosity by sharing my time, energy, and material resources with those who are in real need. I am determined not to steal, not to possess anything that should belong to others. I will respect the property of others, but I will prevent others from profiting from human suffering or the suffering of other species on earth. This is the second of the five mindfulness trainings, and I vow to study and practice it.
So use your imagination. What would that look like in our life? Now the third. Kamesu mitchachara where ammani sikapadang samariyami. I undertake the training to refrain harm through sexual misconduct.
Aware of suffering caused by sexual misconduct, I am committed to cultivating responsibility and learning ways to protect the safety and integrity of individuals, couples, families, and society. I am determined not to engage in sexual activities without love and commitment. To preserve the happiness of myself and others, I am determined to respect my commitments and the commitments of others. I will do everything in my power to protect children from sexual abuse and to protect couples and families from being harmed by sexual misconduct. This is the third of the five mindfulness trainings, and I vow to study and practice it.
And now the fourth. Musawada where ammani sikapadang samariyami. I undertake the training to refrain from false and harmful speech.
Aware of the suffering caused by unmindful speech and the inability to listen to others, I am committed to cultivating loving speech and deep listening in order to bring joy and happiness to others and relieve others of their suffering. Knowing that words can create happiness or suffering, I am determined to speak truthfully with words that inspire self-confidence, joy, and hope. I will not spread information that I do not know to be certain, and will not criticize or condemn things of which I am not sure. I will refrain from uttering words with the intention of causing division or discord. I am determined to make efforts to reconcile and resolve all conflicts, however small. This is the fourth of the five mindfulness trainings, and I vow to study and practice it.
And now the fifth. Sura Maria Maja Pamaratana Where Amini Sika Padang Samariami. I undertake the training to misuse of intoxicants.
Aware of the suffering caused by unmindful consumption, I am committed to the cultivation of good health, both physical and mental, for myself, my family, and my society by practicing mindful eating, drinking, and consuming. I will ingest only items that preserve peace, well-being, and joy in my body, in my consciousness, and in the collective body and consciousness of my family and society. I am determined not to misuse alcohol or any other intoxicant, or to ingest foods or other items that undermine spiritual growth, such as unwholesome TV programs, magazines, films, and conversations. I am aware that to damage my body or my consciousness with such poisons is to harm all beings. I understand that a proper diet is crucial for self-transformation and for the transformation of society. This is the fifth of the five mindfulness trainings, and I vow to study and practice it.
Then we end with the bottom on page 37. Idam me silang Maga phalanyana sa pachayo hotu. May my conduct conduce to attainment the highest fruits of liberation. Taking refuge, undertaking the five mindfulness training, and practicing the way of awareness and insight gives rise to benefits without limit. I offer to share all blessings and merit with my parents, teachers, family, friends, and with all beings everywhere. May this life and practice contribute to the great stream of causes and conditions leading to happiness, peace, and liberation for all beings. May all beings be happy. So that's our quarterly refuge and precept recitation. And this book, we're actually redoing our guidebook or chant book, but this book is currently up on the website. So if you want to incorporate this into your practice, please print yourself a copy of it.
This talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.